The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 13th, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is once again set in front of the Supreme Court building. The block of five conservative justices are standing on the front steps with their arms folded across their chest. Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Clarence Thomas. The steps underneath them are showing cracks, and in the background, there's debris flying. A couple of the columns are falling off to the side. The roof is caving in back behind them, and the headline is Earthquake: The Implications of the Supreme Court Overturning Roe. There are several articles dealing with that today, including the first main story. We'll start there. Supreme Court preparing to overturn Roe. What happened? A political earthquake shook the nation this week as a leaked draft ruling revealed that the Supreme Court's conservative majority is poised to overturn Roe v. Wade, enabling states to criminalize abortion for the first time in a half century. Roe was egregiously wrong from the start, wrote Justice Samuel Alito in the draft, and must be overruled. That majority opinion of the court, which lets stand a Mississippi law banning abortions after 15 weeks, asserts that the landmark 1973 ruling and a subsequent ruling called Casey invented a constitutional right to abortion and to privacy that's not present in the document. If the ruling becomes law at the end of the Supreme Court's term early this summer, states will be free to ban or severely restrict abortion, a move 26 states are likely to make. Conservative Justices Brett Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett have voted along with Alito to overturn Roe, reported Politico, which published the leaked draft. Chief Justice John Roberts reportedly may issue his own opinion upholding the Mississippi law's restrictions, but not overturning Roe, meaning that the ruling to overturn would be 5-4. Roberts called the unprecedented leak of an entire draft opinion a betrayal of the confidences of the court and ordered an investigation. The revelation set off a flurry of activity among state officials, with Republicans moving to ban or severely restrict abortion, and Democrats vowing to turn their states into safe havens for women seeking abortions. They will be welcomed, and they will be served, said Washington Governor Jay Inslee. President Biden called the opinion radical, and he joined other Democrats in warning that it could open the door to revoke other rulings based on the right to privacy and personal autonomy, including same-sex marriage. Pro-choice activists marched in cities such as Chicago, Atlanta, and Houston, while those who have worked for decades to construct a Supreme Court that would ban abortion rejoiced that their hour was seemingly at hand. Decades of steadfast prayer and unwavering legislative efforts to protect the lives of the unborn, said Oklahoma Republican House Speaker Charles McCall, are finally on the doorsteps of success. What the editorial said. A nightmare scenario is hurtling toward reality, said the Houston Chronicle. For tens of millions of American women, it will mean a return to the dismal era of coat hangers and back alleys once relegated to our grandmother's memories. A solid majority of Americans wanted to keep Roe in place by a 2-to-1 margin, according to a new Washington Post ABC News poll. This court is arrogantly dismissing public will and a major court precedent only because of the disastrous presidency of Donald Trump, whose three court appointees created a radical conservative majority now ushering in a Democratic crisis. Alito is right, said the Wall Street Journal. His carefully argued and comprehensive ruling correctly shoots down the 1973 court's legal invention of a constitutional right to privacy that guarantees abortions. A contortion even many liberal law experts and former Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg have criticized. Overturning Roe won't end abortion. It will just defer the matter to the states where this profound moral question will be debated and settled the way it should be in a democracy, by the people. What the columnist said, we're seeing the tyranny of the minority in action, said Jessica Winter in The New Yorker. Four of the five justices ready to overturn Roe were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote and confirmed by a Senate constructed to give disproportionate power to sparsely populated rural red states. This catastrophic ruling will primarily affect poor women of color who may lack the means to go to other states where abortion remains legal, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate. Its blatant right-wing partisanship also destroys what was left of public confidence in the Supreme Court's legitimacy. Actually, Roe's reversal would represent the system finally working as it should, said David Harsanyi in National Review. It means ending an unconstitutional judicial overreach and returning a political issue to the states. The court's job is to uphold the Constitution, not mandate by fiat. Tellingly, democracy's purported defenders are afraid to move this fraught issue into the political realm where it should have been all along. Overturning Roe isn't a conservative choice, it's a radical one, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. As a conservative myself, I believe Roe was legally faulty, but it's been the law of the land since 1973. And to reverse it now will light a cultural fire in a nation already ablaze with division. This act of judicial activism will badly damage the court's ability to serve as a steward of whatever is left of American steadiness and sanity. The controversy of the week is Twitter. Will Musk go through with the deal? Putting electric cars on the road, sending rockets to space, Elon Musk has achieved some incredible things, said Rachel Lerman in the Washington Post. But he sometimes doesn't follow through on his grand plans, and there are many reasons his accepted offer to buy Twitter for $44 billion could fall apart. Vowing to open the site to more free speech, Musk has bet a huge chunk of his personal fortune on the deal, including a third of his stock holdings in his car company, Tesla, whose share price dropped 12% after the announcement. Moreover, Tesla builds half its vehicles in and gets a quarter of its revenues from China, whose authoritarian rulers may use that leverage to demand Twitter's new owner take down posts about Hong Kong protest or Taiwan's independence. Musk deserves credit for trying to break Silicon Valley's culture of progressive conformity, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. He said in a tweet last week that for Twitter to be politically neutral, it must upset the far right and the far left equally. But what does that mean in practice? Does Musk realize he's walking into a hornet's nest? In practice, Musk would make Twitter a much darker place than it already is, said Charlie Warzel in TheAtlantic.com. If Musk stands by his original promise to allow all speech that's legal under the First Amendment, the platform will become a cesspool of hate, harassment, and false information. Not only would Donald Trump's Twitter account be reinstated, peddlers of white nationalism, anti-vax nonsense, and QAnon claptrap would come flooding back like a tsunami of sewage. A more likely scenario is that Musk modestly loosens the content moderation rules, and when no one is happy with the results, he loses interest in the day-to-day operations. What a double standard, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. When conservatives complained that big tech was censoring vaccine skepticism, stories about Hunter Biden's laptop, and people who think that trans women aren't really women, liberals scoffed, arguing that a private company like Twitter has a perfect right to set whatever content moderation policies it wants. Now that Musk wants to open Twitter to verboten ideas, the left has performed a screeching U-turn, proclaiming that Musk's ownership would be an intolerable assault on democracy. Sorry, but our deepest political divides can't be moderated away. If you want to see the future of Musk-owned Twitter, said Ezra Klein in the New York Times, look at the billionaire's own tweets. He recently posted an unflattering picture of Bill Gates with a pregnant man emoji and the puerile caption, in case you need to lose a boner fast. He joked that, I'm buying Coca-Cola to put the cocaine back in, and responded to a critical tweet from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by saying, stop hitting on me. Sophomoric, reckless, often cruel, Musk's tweets are the purest embodiment of Twitter itself, a platform that gamifies public discourse and rewards vicious dunks and outrageous statements with high follower counts, likes, and retweets. If Musk follows through and buys the platform, he will be Twitter. Then we may finally see Twitter for what it truly is, a public forum designed to dumb down complex arguments into simplistic, nuance-free 280-character reposts and turn public discourse into a game. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for earplugs. After country star Garth Brooks and 102,000 fans at Louisiana State University's Tiger Stadium hit 95 decibels while belting out Callin' Baton Rouge, loud enough to register on a seismograph and to risk causing temporary hearing loss. It was a good week for persistence after Brazilian man Walter Orthman set a Guinness World Record for working at the same textile company for 84 years. You need to get busy with the present, not the past or future, said Orthman, 100 years old. And it was a good week for meeting face-to-face, after a study found that workers think more creatively in person than in video conferences. Researchers found that when people are free to look around a room rather than stare at faces on a screen, they have more and better ideas. But it was a bad week for typos, after a stock trader at Citi made a mistake inputting a single transaction, leading to a $315 billion crash in European markets. The stocks recovered after the error was corrected. It was a bad week for keepsakes after an American family caused a panic at Israel's airport in Tel Aviv when they arrived at security with an unexploded bombshell that one of their children found in the Golan Heights. The family wanted to take the bomb home as a souvenir. And finally, it was a bad week for web searches, after a conservative member of British Parliament resigned after being caught watching porn on his phone in the House of Commons. Neil Parrish, 65, claims he was looking for a website about a tractor called a Dominator, followed a link, and kept watching in a moment of madness. And a short and other news piece on this page. COVID cases spread after correspondents' dinner. After widespread hand-wringing over the safety of the first in-person White House correspondents' dinner in 2 years, multiple journalists who attended it last week tested positive for COVID-19 days later. Among them was Jonathan Carl of ABC News, who shook hands with President Biden. Everyone on stage with Biden was tested in advance, suggesting Carl likely was not contagious. Steve Herman, a Voice of America correspondent, also tested positive. But with many parties before and after the dinner, tracing infections is difficult. Biden's top medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, skipped the event over personal COVID concerns. On stage at the dinner, comedian Trevor Noah joked that was it a super spreader event in the making. The title of our briefing this week is Prosecuting War Crimes. History shows that it's difficult to hold war criminals accountable. Will Vladimir Putin and his army ever face justice? What constitutes a war crime? War crimes are serious violations of the international laws of war against either combatants or civilians. And there's no question Russia has committed them in Ukraine. The Russian military has launched missiles at apartment buildings, bombed a maternity hospital and children's shelter in Mariupol, and slaughtered hundreds of civilians in Bucha and other towns and cities they've occupied, leading President Biden to say Putin is a war criminal who should be held accountable. Biden later escalated his condemnation, saying that he believes Russia is committing genocide, the attempt to systematically destroy, in whole or in part, an ethnic or racial group or a national identity. But war crimes prosecutors have never pursued a target quite as big as Vladimir Putin. It's the first time in decades a major power has flagrantly broken humanitarian laws on a massive scale, said Una Hathaway, director of the Center for Global Legal Challenges at Yale Law School. The international legal order is really under stress. How were war crimes laws established? Early international treaties, such as the Hague Conventions of 1899 and 1907, established some laws of war. But there really was no settled conception of what a war crime was, said Michael Bryant, author of A World History of War Crimes. After World War II, the landmark Nuremberg trial set lasting precedents by prosecuting Nazi leaders for crimes against humanity. This is really where the modern definition of war crimes comes into being, Bryant said. The Geneva Conventions, ratified in 1949, established humanitarian war standards that hoped to relegate the mass carnage of World War II to the past. These new laws of war forbade not only the atrocities of Nazi Germany, but also the deliberate targeting of civilians, such as the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the mass bombings of the cities by both Allied and Axis forces that killed millions of civilians. In ensuing decades, deadly conflicts in Cambodia, Vietnam, Chile, Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and elsewhere took millions of lives and heightened cries for enforcement. In the late 1990s, international courts began prosecuting heads of state for atrocities committed during war. Has that system worked? To a limited degree. Former Yugoslavian president Slobodan Milosevic was tried for war crimes at a UN tribunal in The Hague, but he died of a heart attack less than 2 months before the verdict was due. The Rome Statute, which took effect in 2002, established the International Criminal Court, a tribunal tasked with prosecuting war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide when domestic courts will not hold political or military leaders accountable. But the ICC can only prosecute leaders when it gets its hands on them, and it has mostly gone after African despots who have been overthrown and turned over by their home countries. Russia, Ukraine, and the United States are not signatories to the Rome Statute. What crimes is Russia guilty of? Ukrainian courts have charged 10 captured Russian servicemen for holding civilians hostage during the occupation of Bucha. It's investigating more than 8,000 additional crimes with the help of the U.S. and other countries. But genocide would be hard to prove without clear-cut evidence of intent, said Leila Sadat, a war crimes expert at Washington University in St. Louis. When prosecutors investigated the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia, they pored through documents and cell phone intercepts for evidence there was a conscious plan to exterminate Bosnian Muslim men and boys. Circumstantial evidence isn't sufficient, Sadat said. You have to go into the mind of the perpetrator. In this case, they may have to prove that Putin wants not just a political takeover of Ukraine, but the erasure of people who consider themselves Ukrainians. So, will Putin go on trial? Not without a coup in Russia. If other countries indict Putin and his generals as war criminals, it will be largely symbolic unless they venture onto unfriendly foreign soil. And despite the near universal condemnation of Putin in the West, the world's major powers don't want to set a standard that could make them accountable to international courts themselves. When the ICC tried to investigate U.S. personnel for possible war crimes in Afghanistan, which is an ICC member, the U.S. resisted and even sanctioned ICC members. The court has now effectively abandoned that investigation. Certain large powers were worried. Is it going to turn on us? Said Philippe Sands, a leading international lawyer. The ICC is conducting a preliminary investigation of potential Russian war crimes and crimes against humanity, but it has never prosecuted a non-signatory for the crime of aggression or the waging of an illegal war. You're going to end up in 7 years' time with trials of mid-level folks, Sands said. The political and military leaders calling the shots from Moscow, he said, are never going to go to justice. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with Endangering the Life of the Mother. The vast majority of Americans support abortion in cases of rape, incest, and complications that threaten the life of the mother, said Michelle DeMarco. But many recently passed state abortion laws erase the rape and incest exceptions. And those subtle shifts in language could condemn some women with dangerous pregnancies to death. States such as Texas, Alabama, and Mississippi have abortion laws that include ridiculously vague and medically meaningless definitions of what constitutes a life-endangering condition for a pregnant woman. As I can attest, some conditions do not pose immediate threats to the woman's life. I suffer from a coronary condition that caused two heart attacks in my 30s, and doctors told me when I became pregnant that continuing it would be tantamount to suicide. When 26 states soon ban abortion, will women like me be held in suspicion and forced to submit to a politician's definition of life-threatening conditions? Will doctors be afraid to save women's lives because they face lawsuits or prison? My decision to have an abortion was truly the hardest, most anguishing decision I've ever made, and perhaps surreally also the most obvious. Such decisions should not be made by governments. The GOP's plan to steal 2024. Republicans who still insist the 2020 election was stolen aren't really trying to undo those results, said J. Michael Luttig, a retired federal judge and lifelong Republican. Their real objective is to execute successfully in 2024 the very same plan they failed in executing in 2020. If Donald Trump or his anointed successor loses again, their radical plan's cornerstone is the little-known independent state legislature theory, which argues that under the Constitution, state legislatures possess sole power to decide which slate of electors to send to the Electoral College, even if legislatures choose the losing candidate's electors on some bogus premise. State courts and state election officials cannot intervene. That idea was floated after Trump lost in 2020, but state officials and Vice President Mike Pence refused to go along. Since then, Republicans have worked to elect Trumpists to state legislatures and election boards in key swing states. Republicans also hope to get their independent state legislature doctrine approved by the Supreme Court, with three of its hard right justices having already endorsed it. Beware. The GOP is poised to steal from Democrats the presidential election in 2024 that they falsely claim the Democrats stole from them in 2020. This column comes from Germany. A pop star's journey to hell and back. Xavier Naidoo is one of Germany's biggest pop stars. Or at least he was, said Volker Probst. Born in Mannheim to South African immigrant parents, the singer shot to fame as a luminary of cuddly soul in the 2000s and was the voice of the summer fairy tale of 2006 when we hosted the World Cup. But in the years since, his ever more offensive views have made him persona non grata. He has peddled conspiracy theories about 9/11, denied the existence of COVID, and promoted QAnon lies about child blood drinking elite. Oddly, this German of color also became an extreme right winger, a nationalist, and an anti-Semite. And then, it seems, he saw the light. In a video recently posted on Instagram, Naidoo apologized, admitting to taking wrong paths and being blinded by conspiracy stories. The reason for his transformation? His wife is Ukrainian, and the unbelievable suffering unleashed during Russia's invasion made him question his hateful views. Now, he says, he stands instead for tolerance, diversity, and peaceful coexistence. Of course, his Damascene conversion is being welcomed by most, though not by his former friends in conspiracy circles, who have furiously branded him a traitor. But it remains an open question whether his former fans will be able to overlook the damage he inflicted with his unhinged rants. And it's time for the last word, our feature article. The title this week, The Women Who Hunted the Taliban. A platoon of Afghan women soldiers joined U.S. Special Forces on search and combat missions, said Amanda Ripley in Politico. Now they are in exile in the U.S., trying to adjust to new lives. In the cramped kitchen of a Chick-fil-A in Pittsburgh, out of the customer's line of sight, there is a slight 26-year-old woman in a headscarf making chicken sandwiches. She looks up every few seconds to check the drive-through screen. It beeps insistently like a hospital heartbeat monitor, detailing each new custom order for her to assemble. No cheese, yes bacon, no tomato. She folds each leaf of lettuce so it tucks underneath the bun, just so. Her coworkers know her as a quiet employee with limited English who learns fast. It feels impossible to explain, almost like it never happened. A year ago, Naheed was running off of U.S. military Chinook helicopters into remote compounds in the middle of the night, carrying an M4 assault rifle and scanning the horizon through the green haze of night vision, searching for Taliban and ISIS targets. She conducted some 50 midnight raids alongside Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and Army Rangers. One night, a grenade thrown out of a second-floor window killed three male Afghan soldiers standing nearby. She stood guard over an injured American soldier, firing into the darkness to ward off further attacks, praying for his survival until air support arrived. And then, 6 months ago, she boarded a C-17 military cargo plane out of Kabul, sitting on the floor with hundreds of her countrymen, heading toward an American life she hadn't really asked for, but was thankful to get. For 6 years, Naheed was known as a courageous and highly effective soldier, part of a covert unit of female Afghan fighters created and trained by U.S. Special Operations. In a country where most women did not leave home without a male escort, her unit, the Female Tactical Platoon, worked alongside elite strike forces, doing the work that male soldiers could not do in a Muslim country, searching and questioning women and children on high-risk nighttime missions. From the time the platoon was set up in 2011 to the fall of Kabul in 2021, the women conducted some 2,000 missions. And now she is here, one of 39 members of the female tactical platoon to be evacuated to the United States in the chaos that followed the fall of Kabul in August. The platoon members spent the fall in pop-up refugee camps on military bases. But now, all these women and 85 of their family members are officially resettled, which is to say they are scattered across 26 cities, from Atlantic City, New Jersey, to Anchorage, studying English, looking for work, and trying to reconcile their past with their present. The fate of these unusual women is outsized importance to their American military counterparts and to the Taliban. They are an affront to everything the Taliban stands for, a Green Beret officer who served alongside four female tactical platoon members in Afghanistan told me. They were one of the few groups who were killed on sight for the Taliban. If they were captured, they would be killed. When U.S. Army Major Laura Peters, part of a newly formed unit called the Cultural Support Team, embedded with U.S. Special Operations Forces, was told about the creation of a new and unusual unit of Afghan soldiers a decade ago, she was highly skeptical. It seemed dangerous at best, doomed at worst. Train Afghan women as elite fighters and send them into the worst parts of Taliban-held Afghanistan? At the recruiting sessions, 100 women would show up, and after hearing the job requirements, only 10 would return. The only reason Peters and her colleagues kept trying was because they understood how valuable these women could be, in theory. In any tribal community, women know where the men are, where the weapons are, and who hid a phone in the floorboards. Male soldiers couldn't talk to or search these women. Local Afghan men might punish or even kill the woman who'd been interviewed along with her children. Peters and her team ended up selecting a dozen recruits, picking women who could get permission from their families to join, who passed psychological and character screenings, which assessed, among other things, if they were willing and able to maintain a cover story with friends and neighbors. They taught them to shoot and to lift weights. Then they moved on to other skill sets: how to search a room, how to question a suspected terrorist, how to run in boots while wearing night vision goggles. The first surprise for the Americans was the relentlessness of the new recruits. None of these females wanted to quit, which was amazing, Peter said. The other surprise was the joy. The women had to do weekly 12-mile walks, carrying 35 pounds of gear in scorching heat, all while wearing hijabs and long-sleeved shirts and pants. But even then, there was this current of delight just under the surface. "Oh my gosh, there was so much giggling and laughter," Peter said. "The women were learning to kick down doors and fast rope out of a helicopter, wielding a kind of power that had been, until then, unimaginable." One of the earliest recruits was a woman named Matab, who had worked as a calligraphy teacher before joining the military. As a soldier, she attended college at night, earning a bachelor's degree in political science. She rose up through the ranks, becoming the platoon's commander for 7 years. Matab was recently resettled in the D.C. area, and in January, I met her at La Peace, an Afghan restaurant in the city, along with Ellie, a U.S. Army captain and one of the service members most involved in helping the platoon members resettle. Politico agreed not to disclose Ellie's real name because she remains on active duty and is not authorized to speak on the record. When Matab thinks back to those early days, she remembers how hard and how thrilling it was all at once. "Each day was different from the one before," she said, barely touching her food. "On missions, you couldn't predict what would happen next," she said. "It was like being in love." Matab remembers one raid in Helmand province when a group of about 75 Army Rangers and Afghan special operators were searching for a suspected Taliban commander. The first house they went to around midnight turned out to be the wrong one, based on bad intelligence. Matab went inside the courtyard to question the family and found herself being stared at by a girl with big round eyes. "Are you a female?" the girl asked when she heard Matab's voice, her eyes moving from Matab's gun to her night vision goggles to her headscarf sticking out underneath her helmet. "Yes," Matab answered. "Can you give me something to keep?" Matab understood that she was, to this girl, a unicorn, and the girl wanted proof that unicorns exist. She checked her pockets. She had a pen and some peanuts, nothing special, but she handed them over. "Here, eat these peanuts," she told the girl. "I will never eat them," the girl vowed. "I will keep them all my life." The girl's name was Anargul, which means pomegranate girl in Dari. Later that night, still struggling to identify the target, Matab returned to the house and called for Anargul. She and her family helped Matab and the commandos figure out where the Taliban suspect could be found. Soon the American women noticed male commandos were not just being ordered to bring platoon members on missions, they were actively requesting their assistance. "We spoke the same language and understood the culture," explains Matab. "When I searched a female, I'd say, 'I am Muslim, you are Muslim. I am Afghan, you are Afghan. I am a woman, you are a woman.'" One of the younger platoon members recruited by Matab was a woman named Nafisa, whose last name Politico has agreed not to publish. She joined in 2018, serving in one of the most violent phases of the war. Over the course of 3 years, she went on about 60 missions and fired her weapon on almost all of them. On one mission in June 2019 at Mazar-e-Sharif, Nafisa and about 50 Army Rangers and Afghan commandos were ambushed 3 separate times over the course of 24 hours. Nafisa was shot but uninjured because of her body armor. Over its decade-long existence, the platoon did not lose anyone in combat, though two of the women were seriously injured. Another time, she tackled a woman said to be wearing a suicide vest, which turned out to be lined with cash, not explosives. Once she discovered a pistol hidden in the swaddling blanket of a baby. Over time, the American female soldiers of the cultural support team became very close to Matab and all of the Afghan platoon members. Between missions, they would hang out in one another's rooms on base, dancing, drinking chai, and doing henna tattoos. For all of their differences, they were all positive deviants of a sort. Women working in a hyper-masculine profession convinced they were making the world safer for other women. The platoon members learned a lot from their female U.S. counterparts, but certain things they did their own way. Many of the Afghan women would show up for work wearing makeup, jewelry, and heels, for example. It didn't matter that they were preparing to go on a night raid in the mountains. The bemused American women started to refer to this as Afghan style. One bitterly cold night, a platoon member came to a mission wearing a long fur coat with a hood up over her helmet and night vision goggles. I gave her a hard time, an American female officer told me. I said, "This is a joke, right? You're not really wearing that, are you?" "If I die tonight, I die pretty," the woman replied. As the American exit from Afghanistan approached, the American women scrambled to help the platoon members apply for visas to enter the U.S., but got nowhere. A few days after the Taliban swept into Kabul, the platoon members finally decided to try their luck at Kabul International Airport. Nafisa, Nahid, Matab, and most of the platoon members were all there, amid the throngs of Afghans trying to escape. Stripped of their weapons and their uniforms, they watched families get trampled and children scream in hunger, and they were unable to help in the ways they were trained to do. It was a terrible feeling to be so powerless so suddenly. For hours, and in some cases days, Ellie and the other Americans bombarded the platoon members on WhatsApp and Signal, trying to get the Afghan women close enough to the airport perimeter so that American soldiers they had connections with could pull them up over the fence. "Push faster, please. Fight hard to get close. It's the only way we can help you." "The U.S. looks strangely familiar," Matab told me, "like it does in the movies. The buildings are tall and beautiful." She is working remotely as an interpreter for an immigration law firm and living with her nieces in a modest apartment beside a freeway in Maryland. "But this time in her life," she said, "is by far the hardest ordeal she has ever experienced. Even harder than war." "People clap for us at the airport," Matab told me. "I appreciate them, but my heart wasn't there. My heart is with my people." When I visited Matab at her apartment in February, she told me about a male colleague who had been tortured and killed by the Taliban. She picked up her phone to show me a picture of his body, covered in burn marks, which had just been returned to his family. Anyone fleeing war or famine endures an impossible kind of psychological splitting. You must start a new life here while everything you know and love is over there. You're neither here nor there. "Sometimes I feel like it might be easier if I were there," Matab told me. "Now I am safe, but it's hard to accept." Recently, to keep herself sane, Matab vowed to memorize a poem and make a drawing each week. Someone sent her a video of an Afghan woman in traditional dress dancing, whirling round and round, dancing in spite of everything. She drew the woman dancing in front of an Afghan flag, and she put it up on her bookshelf, next to her photos of the platoon members. This was adapted from a story that was originally published in Politico. We'll read an obituary this week. The country singer who was dogged by demons. Naomi Judd, 1946 to 2022. Before she became a country star, Naomi Judd lived an album's worth of country songs. She'd endured poverty, sexual abuse, divorce, single motherhood, and mental illness by the time she and her daughter Winona formed a duo built around their Appalachian-tinged harmonies in the late 1970s. The Judds became one of the biggest country acts of the 1980s, with a sound combining traditional back porch country and a pop sheen. The pair sold more than 20 million albums, winning 5 Grammys and racking up 14 number one hits, including Girls' Night Out, Why Not Me, and Love Can Build a Bridge. Judd spoke openly about her battles with severe depression, which at times required hospitalization, and which led to her death, reportedly by suicide. "I'm still desperately trying to help myself," she said in 2016, "but I'm vulnerable." Born in Ashland, Kentucky, where her father owned a gas station and her mother was a waitress, Judd grew up in a family marked by trauma, said the Washington Post. She was sexually abused by a great uncle at 3 and later by a boyfriend. She gave birth to Winona at 18, then married a man who'd fathered her second daughter, Ashley, and moved with him to California, where she studied nursing. After they divorced, she returned to Kentucky, where, lacking a phone or TV, she and Winona took to singing around the house for amusement. In 1979, they decided to give Nashville a shot, said the New York Times. There, Judd worked as a nurse, and she and her daughter shared a motel bed while living on bologna sandwiches. They scored a break in 1983 when one of Judd's patients gave a tape to her father, an RCA Records executive who signed the Judds to a deal. A year later, Mama, He's Crazy became their first number one hit. Their career was cut painfully short after Naomi announced she had hepatitis C in 1990, said The Guardian. They quit performing a year later. In the ensuing years, Naomi took acting roles, hosted a talk show, and published a string of books, including a 2016 memoir on her struggles with depression. In the book, she described a 2-year stretch during which I went through the hell of mental illness, saying she was resting from a nightmare, a way to find joy in each day. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page. Got another article here about the Supreme Court leak. A turning point. One of the biggest Supreme Court decisions in generations has inspired one of the biggest Supreme Court scandals ever, said Jim Garrity in National Review. The leak to Politico this week of Justice Samuel Alito's draft opinion overturning Roe v. Wade will cause an earthquake inside the court, destroying trust and collegiality among the justices, clerks, and court employees. The secrecy of justices' deliberations is critical, and although stories of vote switching and other intrigues have spilled out on rare occasions, the publication of an entire draft opinion is unprecedented. Whoever leaked it, probably a clerk for a liberal justice, has an ulterior motive, perhaps to cause a massive public backlash that might give some of the conservative justices cold feet about overturning Roe. Whatever the leaker's motive, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg, it's an institutional calamity, and the court's investigation into the leak will only deepen the suspicion and anger among justices and clerks. The Supreme Court is broken. The simplest explanation, said Jeremy Stahl in Slate, is that an angry clerk of one of the progressive justices leaked the opinion to whip up public outrage and galvanize pro-choice progressives to attack Alito's radical opinion. The shrewdest move, however, would have been if a conservative clerk who loves Alito's opinion wanted to make it impossible for fence-sitters, perhaps Brett Kavanaugh, to opt for a middle-path ruling that left Roe partially intact. Even those of us who see overturning Roe as a calamity should agree that leaking a draft opinion is no act of bravery, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. The court can't function if its internal deliberations run the risk of becoming breaking news alerts. Clearly, whoever decided to leak this opinion was engaging in a raw political act, said Jonathan Turley in USA Today. He or she was willing to abandon every ethical and professional principle to bring outside pressure to bear on the court as it goes through the process of creating its ruling on Roe. If it was a liberal clerk or justice, the leak may backfire, hardening the votes and opinions of the five conservatives who voted to overturn. Whatever the motive, the leak proves definitively that, despite some of the justices' stubborn insistence to the contrary, the court is no longer immune from politics. This is a historic turning point. The court will never be the same. School prayer. When is it coercion? The Supreme Court may soon undercut decades of precedent banning public school-sanctioned prayer, said Joan Biskupic in CNN.com. Last week, the court heard the case of Bremerton, Washington High School football coach Joe Kennedy, who was let go after he refused to stop holding a prayer circle on the 50-yard line after every game. The conservative supermajority appeared sympathetic to Kennedy, suggesting the school district's actions reeked of hostility toward religion and offering plenty of hypotheticals comparing his praying to kneeling during the national anthem or protesting the Ukraine invasion. But the coach's rights are not the only ones that matter, said Caroline Mala Corbin in NBCNews.com. One player, an atheist, said he prayed along because he worried Kennedy might limit his playing time otherwise. School officials offered Kennedy a more private space for prayer than the middle of the field, but he refused. Kennedy has the right to pray, but not to use his public, taxpayer-funded job as coach to run roughshod over the rights of students who have different beliefs. It's not quite that simple, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg. Constitutional precedents on First Amendment cases are complicated and confused, but they turn on whether Kennedy's students felt coerced to go along. This case could boil down to the question of who the coach was when he was praying, an individual practicing his faith after games ended, or an authority figure who represented a government-run school. Teachers and coaches are state employees, but they're not the state's robots, said David French in The Atlantic. Whether they kneel in prayer or protest, they're exercising the free speech rights of all American citizens, and those rights do not end at the schoolhouse door. So let Coach Kennedy pray for all our sakes. Actually, this should not be a difficult case, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. In a 1992 case, the court ruled that public school-sponsored religious activity is inherently coercive because of the pressure students inevitably feel from authority figures and peers to go along. But the new 6-3 conservative majority has made it clear it is eager to reverse previous rulings on religious expression and erode church-state separation. When the court rules, it's likely to side with Kennedy, on the grounds that he never actually said that the school's football program favors Christians, even if students understandably drew that conclusion. And we have some shorter notes. As protesters angered by the death of George Floyd filled the streets around the White House in June 2020, then-President Trump asked then-Defense Secretary Mark Esper about whether soldiers could fire on them. Esper says in a new book, "Can't you just shoot them?" the then president asked. "Just shoot them in the legs or something." The U.S. left behind more than $7 billion in military equipment in Afghanistan after its withdrawal in August, according to a new Pentagon report. The equipment left in Taliban hands include 23,825 Humvees, nearly 900 combat vehicles, 250,000 automatic rifles, 95 drones, and more than 1 million mortar rounds. Russian tanks have a design flaw that causes their turrets to explode when hit by a shell or rocket, resulting in hundreds of destroyed tanks and the instant deaths of their three-man crews. The so-called jack-in-the-box effect is caused by a chain reaction in the 40 shells stored in the turrets. At least 20 coaches who were banned from participating in Olympic-affiliated sports because of sexual misconduct convictions or credible allegations are still working with young athletes. The U.S. Center for Safe Sport, founded in 2018, currently bans about 1,400 coaches, but it lacks jurisdiction over most sports programs in which 45 million children participate. On the poll watch, 82% of Americans say abortion should be legal if a woman's health is in jeopardy. 79% support abortion in cases of rape or incest. 48% of respondents think abortion should be permitted when a woman cannot afford to have a child, while 45% think that should be illegal. 75% of Democrats, 53% of independents, and 36% of Republicans want to uphold Roe versus Wade. And we'll finish out the show today with a quote from Mark Twain. He says, "If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything." I like that one. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you'd like more information or if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.